We have 6 cases on our docket today, 5 for oral argument. We'll probably take a break sometime along there. We'll start with U.S. v. Ray, 16-1306.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Jason Wysoki on behalf of Appellant. I would like to start off, even though there are several issues in this case, discussing the interstate agreement on detainers issue. The fundamental question presented by this is whether the government triggered the IAD. And the answer has to be yes in this case. The purpose of the interstate agreement on detainers, as stated in Article 1, is to provide the cooperative procedures that will govern how a receiving state obtains a prisoner from a sending state. The IAD is not the exclusive means for doing this, but as set forth in the Speedy Trial Act, 18 U.S.C. 3161 at subsection J, there it outlines that the government, if it knows somebody is in custody serving a sentence, they have one of two options. One is to undertake to obtain the presence of the prisoner for trial, or file a detainer. And what is...
one question
here, yes, sir,
is, before the statute is invoked, there has to be a detainer filed by the federal government. Is that correct?
Yes.
And the judge found that there wasn't a detainer. It was an evidentiary issue. There was some evidence that there had been a detainer. The judge believe the other evidence that there was a detainer. How can we find that there was a detainer, and if we, how can we overturn the district court's finding that there was no detainer?
Sure.
And if we can't, how can we rule in your favor on that issue?
Well, the first thing we have to do is figure out what is it if it's not a detainer, because it can't be nothing.
That's not really our question. Not what is it, but our only question is it a detainer?
Yes. And the answer to your question is yes, it is a detainer. And the reason why it's a detainer is because it can't be a writ of habeas ad prosequendum, because it's not. It's not a writ of habeas ad testificatum, because it's not. And so the only other means by obtaining Mr. Ray is, because he was in custody at the time, that is undisputed, is through a detainer. It's a detainer because when we look at...
What authority do you have that you get there through the process of elimination, which is what you're doing?
Sure. Well, first of all, as U.S. v. Gonzalez case noted, which is on set out pages 5 and 6 of our reply brief, neither that court nor I could find any case in which a court found that a receiving jurisdiction was able to take custody of a prisoner when they were in the custody of another jurisdiction without some means, either a writ of habeas or a detainer. And the Speedy Trial Act at subsection J lays that out. It says there's two options. There's a detainer or obtain them through undertake to obtain the presence of the prisoner for trial. And the only way to do that is through a writ.
And there's what? I'm sorry.
No, please.
There's no exception that says, and by the way, if you don't seem to come within any of those, then it automatically reverts to being a retainer.
Well,
we've got to have the order. We've got to have the authority.
Sure. And
my understanding is you're relying on a phone call that was made to a liaison for the Department of Corrections there, Colorado.
I think, with all due respect, we're relying on a lot more than just simply a phone call. At Record Volume 2, page 367, is the document in which the receiving jurisdiction clearly understands from the information given to it by the federal government that this is a detainer. Twice, the person in Community Corrections, which is why the testimony from the person who usually deals with detainers down in Colorado Springs is irrelevant. He's not in prison at the time. He is in custody. He's in community corrections. So the call comes through to a different person. And he writes down twice, hold, this guy's under a felony detainer.
And that person who wrote that testified that that was a mistake on his part.
Yes, although what was testified to by the other person who's on this, Mr. Yerke, he said it was accurate and he believed it to be accurate when he received it. Now, obviously, that testimony comes a year and a half after the fact, and it comes when the prosecution is faced with the dire consequences of having violated Bozeman. And what's clear here, if...
Well, that's a good argument on credibility. But the judge is the trial judge is the one who determines credibility and decides what the facts were. The judge might have disbelieved the recanting by the witness, as I'm sure you would describe it, but he didn't. He believed the testimony of the witness.
Sure.
And how can we? But,
well,
go ahead.
I think I want to come back to this fundamental issue, because if it's not a detainer, okay, and we know it's not a writ of habeas.
Well, wait. What?
Yes.
Why can't we say we know it's not a detainer?
Mm-hmm.
We know it's not a writ of habeas corpus ad testificandum. So it must be a writ of habeas corpus ad prosecute.
Quantum, yeah, sure.
Yes. So why? I mean, we can eliminate all three. So why can't we say, since it's not these two, since we know it has to be one of the three, why can't we say, well, we know it's not a detainer or this, so it's this other writ?
Well, I think the main evidence for that is the fact that the person who received this information contemporaneously concluded it was a detainer and wrote that and used that word twice. And what happens if it's... If the IAD was not triggered, and this is why I think oral argument was important in this case, because I do think this is a much broader issue than Mr. Ray. Why don't we see agents going into prisons or going into courtrooms, state courtrooms, and arresting people like ICE and then deporting them? The reason is because the rules of sovereignty and the rules of comity require one jurisdiction to respect those prisoners who are in the custody of another jurisdiction. And the only way to obtain custody of somebody else's prisoner is through some formal process. And so there has to have been a formal process invoked here. Which one is it? We know it's not an ad prosequendum.
The only right way to do it, but a court can take jurisdiction even though the person was unlawfully arrested in another country. You're aware of that. Even if
sure.
The person was kidnapped and brought to this country.
Sure.
So maybe the federal agents here didn't respect the sovereignty of the state. That can offend the state, and the state can get very upset about it. How is that a right of your client?
Sure, and as we concede in the brief, that is not our client's right. But what is our client's right is that once the IAD is invoked, which it was here, based on the plain facts and the undisputed issues in which my client was in custody, he is arrested after a formal notice is given, that formal notice is papered, the date of the issuance of the detainer is April 23rd, the date of arrest, at least as it's to be understood by the state, is supposed to be April 25th. But he's arrested before that. And so what that clearly demonstrates is that the United States government here invokes this detainer process. It then takes Mr. Ray into custody, arraigns him. He doesn't, at the time, contest his detention, but he does reserve the right to do so explicitly. And for whatever reason, the federal government doesn't follow the subsequent formalities required to provide the 30-day notice, to allow the state to then have Mr. Ray sent back. And we know this to be a detainer, and we know the government had to wait under Weeks versus Fleming to prosecute, but decided not to, thereby invoking the IAD, because why was Mr. Ray sent back to the state in the first instance? Because he didn't show up for a parole hearing, because the state thought he was still in community corrections. And that's set forth in Volume 2 of the record. But why was he sent back to the state? Because he needed to have a parole hearing for the sentence that he was serving. And why is the IAD so important? The purpose of the IAD is to ensure that somebody's rehabilitative sentence is not interrupted. That's one of the fundamental core purposes as set forth in Article 1 of the IAD. What is going on with Mr. Ray at the time? He is in community corrections in a classic form of rehabilitation. He's reintegrating into society. That rehabilitation is interrupted. He doesn't have the ability to invoke Article 3 because they don't tell him, oh, this is a detainer and you're under, the IAD has been invoked. So he can then say, hey, I want to go back to the state, finish out my sentence there, which is his right to invoke under Article 3 of the IAD, and wait until that's done, do that rehabilitation before I get to the federal system and go through that process. And because the government invoked the IAD through this detainer by notifying the state receiving it and understanding it as a detainer, Mr. Ray's rights under the IAD were violated. They were violated because he wasn't able to invoke Article 3 when they didn't inform him of it. And then subsequently, when they shuttled him back and forth, his rights to due process were violated, thereby requiring the dismissal of the federal charges. And that is a significant consequence. But it is not a consequence that comes lightly, and it shouldn't. Because when the government, either the state or the federal government, decides it wants to obtain custody over somebody else's prisoner, it has to invoke a formal process so that that prisoner's rights can be protected. We may not like the fact that Mr. Ray, his federal charges, including tax fraud, might get dismissed as a result of the government's mistake.
It has to invoke a formal process. What the statute says, if you invoke this particular formal process,
mm-hmm.
then you have to do these things.
Yes.
Where does it say you have to invoke a formal process?
Well,
that's your
yes.
gloss on it.
That's,
but that's a very important gloss.
It's critical. You're right. And the reason why it's critical is because why do these formal processes exist in the first place? To protect these very fragile but very critical rules and doctrines of sovereignty and comity. And the only reason the IAD exists is because prior to it, states, counties even, and the federal government would just hold detainers over people's heads. And they would just shuttle them back and forth. And now
if there's no detainer, there's nothing being held over his head.
But there is a detainer here. I understand that the judge found the evidence in favor of the government based on testimony that goes against the plain language of the documentation created contemporaneously. But that doesn't mean this court can't reverse.
Now, if there's a detainer, there's an obligation on the holding jurisdiction, right?
Yes.
Okay. So if there's no detainer, there wasn't an obligation. Why couldn't the state say, okay, we're just going to release you. These are more serious charges, and we're not crazy about continuing rehabilitation with this fellow anyway, so we'll just release the person. For whatever reason, when the feds show up and they're ready to arrest the person and prosecute him, why can't the state just say, okay, we're done with this guy. This is much more important.
Well, in theory, the state could. There is absolutely no evidence that that happened here. The best the court could muster was that it assumed that the state consented to Mr. Ray being taken.
You said they could do that. I thought you had said the only way that there can be a transfer is through one of the two habeas writs or through a detainer. So now you're saying there is another possibility. You don't think that's what happened here?
That's
different from your argument before.
Well, if it was, it wasn't intended to be as such. What we know is that in order for a state to relinquish custody, and this is under Weeks versus Fleming, the receiving jurisdiction has to postpone its exercise of jurisdiction until the first sovereign is through with the defendant or they agree to temporarily or permanently relinquish custody. We know the state did not agree to do so because he had to be sent back for his parole hearing that he missed because he was in federal custody. That's how we know the state did not otherwise consent. The only way the state can consent explicitly is through a writ or a detainer. That did not happen here. And the state could not have agreed implicitly, number one, because that's not allowed under the Lunsford versus Hudspeth case, as well as under Weeks versus Fleming. But we know it to be true that the state did not consent because they wanted him back for this parole hearing that he had missed. I would like to read. Go ahead.
I had a question. I guess I'm still struggling. You say you're not just relying on the phone call as evidence of the detainer, but you keep referring back to it, and you ask us to essentially reverse a district court on its finding that basically on the credibility issue. And I guess my question is, even if we agree with you, I still don't see any case law that supports your argument that that notation, even if it meant what it said, was a sufficient detainer. And you rely on the Trammell case, but out of the Seventh Circuit, but it doesn't really help you.
Well, I don't see any
authority for your argument, even if we accept the factual premise for it.
Right. The use of the Trammell cases, as set forth in my opening brief, is to distinguish the facts of Trammell. Trammell establishes this notion that an informal phone call doesn't do it. This is much more than an informal phone call. What it is, hey, we are going to arrest this guy. I see my time is up.
Go ahead.
Thank you. We're going to arrest this guy. You need to keep him. And what happens as a result, as a consequence of that call that doesn't happen in Trammell? The state, the sending jurisdiction, issues a detainer, formalizes the process, and then is set to hold him until the federal government arrests him. But they arrest him before that whole process gets formalized and followed through on. See, my time has expired. Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Hetal Doshi, and I represent the United States. The defendant has raised 5 issues on appeal. None of those issues warrants disturbing the jury's verdict here and the district court's judgment that the defendant was guilty on a number of charges.
Let's focus on the detainer issue, since that's all we got to, and the others really aren't as substantial issues. What do you think? How would you characterize what happened here that doesn't amount to a detainer?
Yes, Your Honor. I think there are 2 requirements to have a detainer. Well, the headline news is the government does not think that there was a detainer here, and therefore the IAD or the Detainer Act is not triggered. There are 2 things that are required to have a detainer under Supreme Court precedent. First, there needs to be a request, and it needs to be a request by someone who has the ability to take custody of a prisoner. And second, and critically, it has to be a request to do something. Typically, that's to hold the prisoner or to notify the receiving jurisdiction that, hey, this prisoner is about to be released, and so we're giving you notification that you should come down here and figure out a way that you want to effectuate this arrest. Those are the 2 requirements. Now, the defendant seems to be focusing on the fact that this telephone call constituted filing of the detainer because of the way that the state employee characterized that telephone call. But the government's argument is the resolution of an oral versus written notification with respect to this telephone call really doesn't have to be decided here today, because the second requirement for a detainer, the requirement that the sending jurisdiction do something, wasn't met. It's uncontroverted in volume six, page 1306, that the testimony that was provided to the district court was, the IRS agent never said the words felony detainer, and maybe that's formalistic, so that's fine. But critically, the state employee who put these notes on this form testified that the IRS agent never asked for anything. It was simply a notification. The IRS agent could have said, this is sort of a weird circumstance. This defendant is serving a community correction sentence. Can you suspend his ability to go out to work? Can you make sure he's here at the appointed time? Can you bring him to us? The IRS agent did not, in fact, make those requests. And that's that critical piece of the detainer.
But the defendant was in state custody. You'd agree with that?
Yes, we would argue.
Okay.
We would agree.
So how can a federal officer just grab someone who's in state custody and take him to federal custody? How would you characterize what was done? It wasn't a writ. You're saying it wasn't a detainer. I'm asking you to respond to his specific argument on this point.
Well, I would agree with Judge Moritz's position that we don't get to the fact that it's a detainer by the process of elimination. The way that this transfer of custody was effectuated...
I'm not sure that's what she was saying, but at least respond to me.
Understood.
Then you can comfort Judge Moore.
Understood, Your Honor.
I'd like to hear your answer to his question.
I think the short answer to your question, Your Honor, is that the way that we transferred custody is through an arrest warrant. And it's the uniqueness of this particular type of term of imprisonment, this being community corrections, that allowed us to do this transfer of custody through an arrest warrant without other process. By analogy, imagine a circumstance where
Mr. What is there about where he is in the program of his rehabilitation, whether he's locked in a cage or out in a service, what justifies us in saying that he's fair game for the federal officials to arrest or otherwise act on him because he is not in a cage as opposed to still under arrest and supervision?
The fact that there was an arrest warrant, Your Honor, and I think that the difference there, if I'm understanding your question correctly, is that should there be a difference between someone who's serving time where they're physically imprisoned versus a community correction sentence? And I think the answer to that is yes, that's meaningfully different, because if we imagine a circumstance where a defendant was on the street and assaulted someone, he or she could be arrested in that moment without any of this other process because of the uniqueness of their term of imprisonment. There's nothing that changes that. The fact that Mr. Ray committed these, or a grand jury found probable cause that Mr. Ray committed these crimes, and therefore the court issued an arrest warrant, is the process that was used here, and it's a proper process.
What, do you have a case that supports that notion that the fact that he was in a rehabilitation program with some freedom to go in and go out means that they don't have to do anything with the state government? They can just go arrest him without any process that involves the state itself?
No, Your Honor, not a case that says specifically that. But I would argue that this court's decision in Weeks v. Fleming is awfully close to that, where it said that a defendant who was serving time in the state of Idaho, who was then charged on federal charges, who was then arrested on those federal charges with an arrest warrant, this court found that that constituted relinquishment of primary jurisdiction, that the arrest warrant was a proper and acceptable way to transfer custody between the state and the federal government. It's contrary to what we know in our common sense and experience to say that if a defendant, because of the particularities of his term of confinement, commits a new crime and is found somewhere unknown to a federal official or any other official, that he can't be arrested, that somehow the existence of that state conviction immunizes him to an arrest warrant.
But we're not involved in a case where the government, the federal authorities, are unaware of his custody by the state. And what you're talking about is the incidental arrest of somebody who is out at liberty in which the government doesn't know it. There's a big difference between those two positions.
I understand, Your Honor, that there's a difference in whether the government has...
And that as long as he's in that custody and that they know it, and that's not subject to dispute here, that some kind of official notification or other action is required in order to uphold the principles of the Act.
Of the Detainer Act, Your Honor?
Yes.
I'm not aware of any authority that requires the government to... that obligates the federal government to avail itself of the Detainer Act or a particular form of process when it has options available.
And that option is to arrest him?
That is one of the options, Your Honor, yes. And I would yeah, further...
Why would that be so, and yet they couldn't come in and arrest him while he's come into the prison and arrest him in his cell?
Well, I think in that circumstance, there is an argument to be made that if a second law enforcement agency, a second sovereign, came into a prison and said, we have an arrest warrant, we want to take this defendant, that the first sovereign, the sending jurisdiction, would have the option to say, no, you need process.
Well, and there's a reason for that. Why is that different? Because he's located in a different place, but still under the same kind of restraint and control by the state. He is a prisoner at the time they executed this action?
For two reasons. Because he's not literally under the same types of conditions and restrictions as he would be if he were incarcerated in a prison. But the second and more important point is that that is something that is up to the state. If Mr. Ray has a remedy with respect to this issue of primary jurisdiction and comity transfer, that is an issue he should be raising with the state of Colorado. I would argue that the notification, the courtesy notification that occurred here, gave the state lead time to say, when you get here, we're going to require process, just like a prison would. They didn't do that.
You think you're basically arguing that there's no personal right by a prisoner to raise the act.
I
think that's the thrust of what you've just argued. Only the state can come in and complain that they abused their relationship.
I apologize, Your Honor, if that's what I implied. That is not the proposition that I'm advancing. I'm simply arguing that an individual defendant may have a remedy under the Interstate Agreement on Detainers, but only when there is proof positive that there was, in fact, a detainer. There seems to be a misalignment here where Mr. Ray is seeking the remedy for a violation of the Interstate Agreement on Detainers as a result of a problem with jurisdiction. And I would argue that those two things aren't synonymous, and we can't conflate them. There is a hook for the Detainer Act to apply, and that is the existence of a detainer. The district court here considered the testimony. It weighed the testimony and found that a form filled out a day after the arrest for the internal purpose of saying this defendant is no longer eligible for community corrections because of the existence of new felony charges, not the arrest. That form is insufficient to constitute a detainer, and there's nothing about that testimony that the defendant has pointed to that constitutes clear error.
So are you saying he just didn't make the right argument?
I think that the district court got it right.
I'm not asking if the district court addressed his argument because the district court did. I'm asking, do you think he just didn't make the right argument here?
I think that he didn't make the right argument in the right venue, I think is the way that I would answer that. I think that to the extent that he has an issue with the fact that the state of Colorado relinquished jurisdiction, and we know that they did for a number of reasons, including the fact that the state of Colorado itself filed a detainer in federal court for this defendant, that if he has an issue with that, that issue should be properly taken up with the state of Colorado. Now, if there had been a request coupled with an action or some sort of thing that we were requesting that the state of Colorado did, then that would properly be a detainer, and therefore there the cascading obligations and responsibilities under the Detainer Act would apply.
So if I'm understanding you correctly, you're saying his problem is, or his complaint really is, that the state shouldn't have allowed the feds to arrest him from community corrections, given that there was no writ and no detainer. And perhaps he has some remedy in the state proceedings for the interruption of his custody in the state case. Is that...
Perhaps. I think that's the best argument that he has. I don't know that he has a strong argument there either, because I think the state is within its discretion under the doctrine of primary jurisdiction to say, while we may exercise primary jurisdiction, we don't have to. As, you know, one of the judges just pointed out, I believe, if the state decides these are more serious charges and we want to relinquish jurisdiction, the state has the option to do that. And so, to your question, Your Honor, I think that that is the best argument he could make, but I still don't know if that's a particularly strong argument. I think this defendant had an arrest warrant. He was in a community corrections program, which meant that he could have been found on the street. He could have been found there. There was a telephone call made, as we should encourage, between two sovereigns operating in the same jurisdiction to say, we're going to stop by maybe later to arrest this individual. They didn't ask for anything else. The ills that the Interstate Agreement on Detainers was designed to address, with, you know, the detainer languishing over someone's head, preventing them from accessing certain programs, things like that, that simply didn't happen here. The arrest was executed on April 22nd of 2014, April 23rd, because of the new charges, not because of the detainer, as alleged by the state or as alleged by the defendant. The defendant was no longer eligible for community corrections. There's a difference between those two things. That's why there isn't a detainer, and that's why this jurisdictional argument doesn't provide the remedy under the Detainer Act. I would also argue that should this court find that there was a detainer in place, that this, that the district court's factual findings constituted clear error, and therefore that the district court got it wrong, the remedy in the circumstance, because the United States is the receiving party, could be with or with a dismissal with or without prejudice, which is different because of the United States' unique status under Section 9 of the Interstate Agreement on Detainers. We again believe that there was no detainer at issue here. The district court properly considered and weighed the evidence and found that there was no detainer, and therefore the remedy available under the Detainer Act shouldn't be triggered. But should the court find it were to be, we would ask that the district court have discretion to dismiss with or without prejudice under Section 9. I was planning to move to the other issues with my remaining 1 minute, but it seems like the court's interested primarily in the Detainer Act. So unless the court has any additional questions, I may. Terrific. Thank you very much.
Your time has expired. I'm going to give you 30 seconds, so be sharp. No.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. What I would point out to the court is that it is critical, the timeline of events here. The detainer issued, which again is Record Volume 2, page 367, notes the date of the issuance of this, 4/23/14. The date of arrest is supposed to be 4/25/14, as set forth in that document. So what happened here is the state did not even have the ability to object, because he was arrested before any processes were put in place.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Case is submitted. Looks like counsel can be excused. You don't have any other arguments here, so we'll turn to our next case, 16-1393 U.S. versus Martinez.